Hello, I'm Ken McLeod, Principal Teacher at Unfettered Mind. Our website is an ongoing effort to explain Buddhist practice in a way that is clear and accessible to the Western mind without dumbing it down. If you find these teachings useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can continue to maintain and expand the site. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind. Buddha nature answers what question?
This is our second class on then and now, and the focus for this evening is on the topic of Buddha nature. I left you with one question, or I put up one question on Facebook. For those of you who are new this evening, we have a group on Facebook called Then and Now with no spaces. It's now got 38 members. So word spreading, which is great. And that's where I'm going to put class assignments, and people can post resources connected with the class that they find useful. So it's a place to share information. And the question that I put up there was for you to think about is, what is the question for which Buddha nature is the answer? And I'd be interested in hearing any reflections that any of you may have had. What is the question for which Buddha nature is an answer? Steve, do you have the mics there? Yeah. Anybody? Pat, could you have Pat a mic, please?
Well,
it's on. It's on, isn't it, Steve?
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, maybe it's just too simple, but I just kept coming back to how to stop suffering.
Okay, that's one possibility. Anybody else? Joe?
What is the nature of good and evil?
Okay. What is the nature of good and evil? Anybody else? How many of you thought about this? Oh, good. Well, let's hear some of your thinking. Back here. It's your name?
Kathy.
Kathy, right. Just takes me a little while to learn.
What is our essence?
What is our essence? Okay. Anybody else? There are a bunch of hands here. Harold. We have a second mic, don't we? Okay.
Yeah, my comments similar to that. When I read about it and thought about it, it confused me because it seemed to imply, it implies it as a self. And
seems
and this
to
just
imply,
popped in my mind. Okay, yeah. So I'll share it with everybody. Yeah, and that causes me confusion.
Yeah, we have this little teaching in Buddhism called non-self, right? Yeah. Okay. Randy?
Almost a seed, the core of what we are that we can use to develop ourselves with.
Okay. And there are some people over here. Art in the background, who's come down from the crow's nest.
Two questions came to mind. What am I and what allows me to awaken?
Okay. And one more. Carrie.
Where do we come from?
Okay. I think pretty well all of these questions are candidates for this. Where do we come from? What am I? How is it possible that I can awaken? What is the nature of good and evil? And so forth. And Harold's comment is very appropriate. What is the difference? I'm going to paraphrase it a little bit, Harold, if it's okay. What is the difference between Buddha nature and a self? I think that's what you're asking, or along those lines?
Along those lines.
Yeah, okay. And certainly from the Theravadan Buddha point of view, they look at Buddha nature and they go, you know, what is the difference between this and the self? You know, that seems like you're making something pretty solid. Well, let's take a look at what it says here, and working from Kensho Gyaltsa translation, this is page 49, and in Gunther's translation, it's all part of chapter 1, this is on page 2, about a third of the way down the page. Now, every spiritual system has to have what I call a map. This actually is something that Karl Potter, the philosopher, put together a long time ago. It has to explain why things are the way they are, and how is it possible for them to be different, and what you can do to make them different. It doesn't matter what spiritual system tradition you're going to embrace. Always those three questions come up. Why are things the way they are? How can it be different? And how can we bring that about? And this is essentially what this chapter is about. Not so much why things are the way they are, but what makes it possible for them to be different. So we see things like, is it possible for inferior persons like ourselves to achieve enlightenment even if we make the effort? That's the question here. What makes it possible for us to wake up? Now, there are a lot of assumptions in that. What does it mean to be awake? Why aren't we awake now, etc.? All of these things. Buddhism, as much as any tradition that I know of, starts with what we experience. And I think we went over this last time. How many of you struggle in your lives? Okay, I'll put it this way. Is there anybody here who doesn't experience struggle in their life? Okay. So that, in a sense, is the first noble truth. There is suffering. I find the word struggle, actually, in today's age, captures the sense of dukkha more accurately. Now, is there another possibility? And that comes to the third noble truth. Yes, there is another possibility. And this notion of Buddha nature is an explanation or an argument to say, here is the possibility. This is what makes it possible. In other words, it's saying that we all have the potential to be awake, which is another way of saying we all have the potential to experience life without the projection of thought and emotion. Or, to put it a third way, we all have the potential to experience life without struggling. And that sounds pretty good. Now, how do we know that we have the potential? Well, what follows is a wonderful example of how self-referential a system that's been around for 1,000 years is. Because it's talking to itself, and in a certain sense it's talking in circles. But let's see if we can break the circle a little bit. The first thing that happens in traditional texts is that they always give scriptural authority for a statement they're making. So we're going to be talking about Buddha nature, and we have such statements as the essence of the well-gone one, which an essence of the well-gone one is a term for Buddha nature, pervades all migrators. Migrators is the term that this person decided to use for beings. And the idea is, the Tibetan word is literally goers. It's the word drowa, which is the verb to go, like I go to the store. And the idea is that they're constantly moving around the six realms of existence. That's the outer interpretation. Another interpretation is, if you look at the six realms as being the worlds that we project when we're caught up in a given emotion, so when we're in anger, we're in the hell realm, when we're in greed, we're in the hungry ghost realm, then it's saying something quite different. And that is, it doesn't matter what realm, it doesn't matter how much we are struggling, the possibility of waking up is always there. That's a very different statement. I also want to talk about this term pervade, because when we say Buddha nature pervades all beings, which is a quotation from many, many of the sutras, we immediately think there is something which pervades everything, and goes back to the 19th century, the ether theory. The ether theory was a theory in physics which said you had this phenomenon that light could travel even through a vacuum, but since light was a wave, at least at that time it was a wave, and waves required a medium, there had to be some kind of medium which pervaded everything. You couldn't send light, a sound through a vacuum, and light, sound requires a medium. In the same way, light, if it's a wave, requires a medium. And so they made up the ether, and eventually it was proven that the ether doesn't exist, but that's another matter. So we have this idea that there's something which pervades all beings. This is a really incorrect understanding of Buddha nature. Jamgon Kontrol, who was one of the great 19th century teachers, was asked this question, and he replied this way: do not think of something which pervades all things, because there isn't any such thing. What is Buddha nature? Buddha nature is what is left when all of the confusion of ordinary experience is cleared away. Let's take a look at that. It's what's left when all the confusion of ordinary experience is cleared away. So in this statement, Kontrol's equating being awake with the end of confusion. And that's a pretty good definition. I was once at a center, and just visiting the center, and a question was posed to the teacher of that center. And it says, what is enlightenment? And I think he wanted to give me a hard time, so he said, I think we'll let Ken answer that question. And that's what my reply was. It's the end of confusion. Now, this doesn't mean that there is something in us which becomes awake. It means that awake quality, which I'll say more about in a minute, is present all the time, and it's just covered over. Now, what is this awake quality? The first thing is, it is not a thing. It isn't something you can point to and say, ah, that's it. In Buddhism, as we do at the beginning of each of meetings here, we say, take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Now, for many people, that's interpreted as taking refuge in the historical Buddha or in the teachings of the Dharma and the Sangha of monks and nuns, which has existed for 2,500 years. And that would be external refuge. And it can be interpreted more internally. But if we look at it from this point of view of Buddha nature, which is not a thing, what we come to in refuge is there is nothing outside us which is going to save us from our struggles. And there's nothing inside us either which is going to save us from our struggles. And I'd just like you to take that and think about that for a few moments. There's nothing inside us and there's nothing outside us. What are you going to do? Now, I find that a very powerful way of looking at this, because it means that there is nothing, it is useless or pointless or futile to look for something to save us. It means that I have to meet my experience, whatever it is, which, at least for me, is not always easy. And one of the things that Buddha nature is saying is, we always have the potential to meet whatever arises in experience. Another way of saying this is that every experience, every situation is workable. And that's... you okay there, Steve? Okay. And that's also very strong. There is no situation which isn't workable. Now, granted, it will feel like there are situations which are completely unworkable. We may not have the capacity, we may not have the skill, we may not even have the willingness to work with situations. But those are all things that we can actually develop. And so the teaching on Buddha nature is a way of explaining what is possible for us, how it is possible for us to wake up or be awake, and it reveals this by saying that every situation is workable. How do we know we have Buddha nature? That's the next question. Here, they give three reasons. If you look on page 50, because the perfect form of the Buddha radiates, because there are no distinctions within suchness, and because all are in a family. Now, there are many translation problems here, among other things. You have one, this wonderful, more or less a syllogism, you know, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. Here the Buddhist version is, all sentient beings are pervaded by the emptiness of Dharmakaya, means that ultimate Buddhahood is Dharmakaya. Dharmakaya is all-pervading emptiness, and emptiness pervades all sentient beings. Now, again, the language suggests that emptiness is a thing. One of the most important aspects of Buddhism is to move away from regarding anything as an entity. Trungpa Rinpoche, who's a wonderful Kagyu teacher, I should have brought this with me. Does anybody have a large piece of paper they can give me? That'll be perfect, Peter, just a page from there. Just need one here. This is such a good piece of paper, it rips very easily. Okay. Two pieces of paper. We would usually say this is small and this is big, right? This one's small, this one's big. Another two pieces of paper. Now this one's small and this one's big. What this points out is there is no inherent quality bigness. Big depends on in relationship to something. Everything, from the Buddhist point of view, everything is like that. Another example. How many of you think that people and things are different? Yeah, right? We most of us think that people and things are different, okay? And you treat people one way and you treat things another way. Okay? Any of you had a pet rock? You know, for a while those were the those were kind of fad, and people related to those rocks as people, or at least pets. Any of you worked in a statistics department or anything like that? There you treat people as things. You know, they're numbers and they comprise things. You don't relate to them in the same way that you relate to someone in the conversation. So whether we relate to people as things or people, or relate to things as things or people, depends on the actual relationship. Those aren't inherent qualities. Those are terms that we use. And when you start beginning to appreciate that absolutely everything is like that, then the world becomes free of entities and the conflict that is set up between entities and the idea of right and wrong, and you're looking at what is actually happening in each of these interactions, because what things are called really depends on the interactions, and the idea that things have inherent qualities which make them what they are falls by the wayside, and you actually begin to relate to things much more as you are experiencing them at that time. So emptiness, which is a very far-reaching concept in Buddhism, particularly Mahayana Buddhism, means that nothing, it is a term which stops the mind and stops us from regarding something as a thing. And we increasingly just experience it, or experience it in terms of our relationship and our interaction with it. This is why in the Zen tradition, for instance, this happened to my teacher, Kala Rinpoche, and a well-known Korean Zen teacher were met in Boston many, many years ago, and there was going to be this big debate between the Tibetan tradition and the Zen tradition. And so they're up on stage, and Sungsun Im, which is totally typical of how things are done in Korean Zen, takes out an orange and says to Rinpoche, my teacher, "What is this?" And Rinpoche says something to the translator, and the translator says something back, and they go on for about 10 minutes back and forth. Eventually, the translator turns to the audience and says, "Rinpoche is very confused. Don't they have oranges where he comes from?" Now, in Zen, if you say, "Well, that's an orange," you would immediately say, okay, you cling to form, you cling to the idea that it's a thing. If you just took it and ate it, then that would be a demonstration that you knew what it actually was. But it's not an object of experience, it's something that is alive and part of one's experience, and one interacts with it. Hey, maybe you could catch it and throw it and make a ball into it, but you would do something. You wouldn't just say, "Oh, that's an orange." But it's very, very different styles of talking about things, so there wasn't much communication. So, rather than thinking of something pervading everything, just take a few moments right now. And I want you to go to the question that I left you as practice, and that was, what makes it possible for your mind to grow quiet? What makes it possible for your mind to grow quiet? All of you have some experience with meditation. Breathe. Rest in the experience of breathing. And at some point you just find you're experiencing breathing. The mind has become quiet. It may only be that way for two or three breaths or something like that. But it's a possibility. What makes that possible? Let's hear from you. Don't think about this. Because in this way of working that we're going to be doing all through this, you need to look at your experience, not try to think it through. Thinking's not going to be helpful. Maya, we have a mic? Yeah, there we are.
I choose to direct my attention to my breath.
Yes, you choose to direct your attention to the breath. What makes it possible for your mind to grow quiet, though?
Is it because the quiet's there? Like, does that make sense?
The quiet's there? Okay. One possibility. But if that's the possibility, if that's the case, do you always know that quiet?
No.
Why not?
I guess what Maya was saying, that you choose not to.
Oh, we'll take it back to Maya then. I have another question for her. Do you actually choose?
What are you referring to?
Well, you said, I choose to do this. Okay, do you actually choose?
I think so. I mean, you try to go below, you know, what comes before choose.
Okay. So you can direct your attention. Can you actually stop thoughts from coming?
No, I haven't figured out how to do that yet.
When you do, let me know. You'll be the first person. Okay. But there is some element of choice in that when you find yourself distracted by a thought, you can choose to continue with the thought or you can come back to the breath, right? Okay. And you're saying that the mind, that the quiet soul is there. Randy, your thought.
The image I had is that these stars are always there, but in the daytime you can't see them because the sun provides noise, static, that obscures the signal. And the possibility of being quiet is there and can be seen only when the noise is absent.
Okay. So how many would go along with this notion that the quiet is always there? Okay. We've got a lot of agreement here. I'm just going to have another small question then. What is this quiet? Anybody want to take a stab at that one? Joe and then Chuck.
The experience you're talking about is most easily describable in the negative. What obscures this thing we're talking about, which we're using the word silence for now. I really can't. There's nothing to say about it, but I know what gets in the way of it.
Okay, very good. Chuck?
Well, it might have something to do with the Buddha nature of just something.
Oh, you're always getting ahead of the game, aren't you? Yeah. Okay. And you're quite right, but I want to get there in some smaller steps. Joe said or offered that it's easier to talk about it than negative, and we get caught up in what it is and what obscures it, etc. But it's very difficult to say what it is. Did I understand you correctly?
Yes.
Okay. Now, this is a very, very important point. It is extremely difficult to say what it is. In fact, if you look at the scriptures, they will say it is impossible to say what it is. Why? Because it is not a thing. But it is something that can be experienced. It's a way of experiencing things that every one of you can move into by creating the right conditions. And as Maya pointed out, there's an element of intention in that. Okay? So, that possibility is present in all of us. And that's what this paragraph is saying. It's using all of this very, very high-flown technical language. Ultimate Buddhahood of Dharmakaya. I mean, that sounds very intimidating. Dharmakaya is all-pervading emptiness, and emptiness pervades all beings. I'm going to translate this into a different way. That is, that quality of being awake is present in everything that we experience. It's present in everything that we experience because nothing that we experience is actually a thing. So there's always the possibility of experience free from projection.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.